Hi, this is Daniel Jalkut.
And this is Manton Reese.
And this is Core Intuition, straight from the source. This week's show is sponsored by Fabric and Linode. Well, Manton, you're talking to a bona fide 100% dyed-in-the-wool, opinionated, dismissive Swift programmer.
Right. Swift world is better now that it has you with it to complain about everything that you don't like.
There sure are a lot more bug reports at Apple.com, that's for sure.
Apple's like, what did we get into now? Daniel just filed 500 bugs about Swift.
I like to say what's wrong with things. That's one of my least and most charming qualities. But I have been, we talked before on a show about, that kind of fun thing about learning something new where you sort of start noticing you're getting to the point where you're not entirely a beginner anymore. And, you start to just kind of feel like, wait, what happened? How did I go from being completely lost to kind of having half of a clue? I'm getting a taste for that, and that feels good. But I am also running up against things where it's like, oh man, this is what they warned me about. This is where the Objective C rubber meets the Swift road, and it's not pretty, and there's skid marks.
So anything in particular, or is it just a lot of little things that are annoying?
It's a lot of little things. I never know quite when I'm going to run into like a thing that's like, what? Seriously, I can't do that? And you know, I know I'm running into far fewer problems than early Swift adopters because I'm taking advantage often. Most of my problems come out of trying to wedge Swift into an existing legacy Objective-C project. And when I say legacy, I mean it with all of the nasty connotations. I'm one of those kinds of developers who, to some extent, I mean, we've talked before how I like to keep like my code pretty up to date. I will fix some deprecation warnings, stuff like that. But I also have a very much if it's not broken, don't fix it attitude about, you know, when you have a certain amount of code, you don't have any other choice. And so I got a bunch of old classes that, I never even quote unquote updated them to Objective-C 2, right? And it turns out, like any new ambitious project, Swift and Xcode support for Swift has a lot of rough edges. And I think the more you bring legacy code and the more you take Apple's offer to mix and match, the more weird situations you're going to run into.
Yeah, it goes more smoothly if you have a kind of a modern Objective-C app, I guess.
Well, that, and I mean, for example, if I were starting from scratch today, I think the smoothest you can possibly hope for is starting from scratch with 100% Swift user code, programmer code, and the only Objective-C bridge crossing being to stuff in Apple's frameworks.
Yeah, which is significant still.
Oh, very significant,
It's kind of funny when we talk about a 100% pure Swift app because it doesn't really exist in some ways because you're still dealing with all the frameworks, you're still dealing with the Objective-C runtime, you're still dealing with a lot of shared code sometimes. Like I mentioned, I started a new client project that I kind of consider 100% Swift, but it's not because it's got this framework that's custom that's all Objective-C and, it's got all the quirks about calling into UIKit and other things that weren't really designed for Swift.
Yeah. I mean, I guess what I've learned in a short order is I kind of have this mental model now where it's like, Swift, if you're going to start moving Swift into your Objective-C heavy source base, start at the leaves of the tree, way down. You don't want Swift ending up somewhere up in your in your sort of source hierarchy. I mean, well, for one thing, you can't inherit from Swift into Objective-C. Mm-hmm. And so that ordains a certain amount of that discipline, but in my experience so far, it also gets a little iffy. Like I started trying to get kind of fancy, being like, I'm going to make this whole new class that is a standalone class. It just inherits from an S object, but I'm going to make it in Swift, and any of my code, whether it's implemented in Swift or Objective-C, can use that. And this class is complicated enough that it's kind of a state machine type class. So it has like delegation methods, it has, you know, completion handlers, it has stuff. That whole like, it declares a protocol that in Swift, that's an Objective-C protocol. I'm just pushing it all the envelope edges here.
You're just trying to break things.
I'm not trying. I'm trying to be good. I'm trying to say like, oh, I need a protocol, but Swift has, you know, support for making, I'm sort of like across that line where I'm sort of trying to say to myself, when I make a new file, can I make it all in Swift? And that I think is a good, it's a good attitude, but it requires a little bit of discretion, because even if like the new file you're making is, you know, pure Swift and it's not going to be subclassed, you know, you won't be tempted to have a subclass that's an Objective-C or anything like that. If it's still being referenced by, and then here's a big, I think, gotcha. If it's got like protocols that are being conformed to by Objective-C classes, things just get a little bit less elegant. And everything from, so as you asked at the beginning, it is more a bunch of little things, but like, for instance, like basically, somehow all of my code completion is basically broken. And I suspect it's because some subtle thing is messing up the indexer. And I don't know how to fix it.
Yeah.
Actually, listeners, do me a favor, hive mind here. You may know there's this like Clang indexer debug level thing you can set, and it'll show all of your Clang indexing errors in the console. I don't think that shows you Swift indexing errors. So I would be interested to know if there's a like environment variable or, you know, user default setting you can set to capture that stuff. But I'm basically having a hard time because, you know, it's on top of like stuff like I did run into a few SourceKit service crashing situations, but then my indexing doesn't work. So, code completion doesn't work. So when I'm like trying to write a Swift line that calls some Objective-C method with like block callbacks,
right,
I'm going like, oh, I got to learn how to like, you know, remind myself again how to write all this like completion stuff out by hand. It's just a bunch of little stuff.
The IDE help you and guide you along really helps me learn a new language, really. It kind of pushes you in the right direction. And even things like warnings and suggestions and stuff, all of that is so much better than it used to be.
Yeah.
I seem to go through phases of when I learn a new language, I program in it like the last language. I noticed that I did this when I started doing a lot of Ruby server work. I would use like the style of and code, like the way I format code and the way I name things and stuff. I'd kind of like keep doing it the way I did it in C or Objective-C or whatever I was using at the time. And then over time, I'll slowly kind of embrace the Ruby way of doing things. And I think that I'm going to do kind of that in Swift as well. Like I'm not very ambitious with my Swift code right now. It looks mostly like I would write an Objective-C app. And maybe that will change, but I just don't care that much, to be honest. I know some listeners will be
Don't tell your annoyed. Client.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I care about
I know you care about app, the quality, right?
But
right.
I don't care if I adopt, like, a perfect Swift way of doing things. So I kind of, I give you credit for trying.
Oh, I'm not trying too hard. Don't give me too much credit. I mean, maybe I misportrayed it a little bit. That just came out of me trying to, I mean, because if I was trying harder, I wouldn't be using an Objective-C protocol, right? I'd be using a pure Swift protocol. I'm basically using Swift.
I feel like the pure Swift, that mentality, I just don't see the point. Maybe I will see it eventually, but I mean, I have an app to write and I don't really care if the app is high quality and it's good and I feel like it's well designed, the architecture of the code is well designed.
Yeah.
I'm not going to like beat myself up if like there's something that's not pure enough about the way the class is defined.
Right. Well, you know, I think it's going to be down the road. We're going to start seeing, I think the people who made Swift made the design decisions they did because they see value in like those Swift only features, things sure. like, you know, even down to like stuff like the optionals, the nullability, and mutability, and all those things that they wanted to really encode into the language, and the type safety. For example, when I declare my array of any object, which I do, that's a very Objective-C thing to do, right? To declare like an array of any object, because you're not quite sure if it's necessarily going to all be one type in there. That's like, that's a smell, right? That's like, that's a situation where my Objective-C legacy is preventing me in perpetuity until I change that design. Yeah. It's preventing me from seeing the advantages of the Swift, like compiler optimizations, whatever. And, you know, so I do appreciate that about Swift, that there are some features where I trust it to optimize for me better down the road. And I try, and by extension, I suspect all of Apple's work into things like refactoring tools, into like static analysis, will eventually move towards being in Swift, so that, you know, the more you adopt a Swift-like way of programming, the more it'll be able to help you, I think.
Yeah, maybe you just caught me on a bad day, but I'm feeling particularly grumpy about this today. Like, I kind of want to retire before I get to this point of, oh, boy. I'm not, I mean, the designers of Swift did some amazing work, and I agree that they're passionate about it. And there's so many developers that are passionate about the approach, but I'm still not convinced. Yeah. I'm still really not convinced that it's all right.
Ooh.
We'll see. I work on it every day now. So, I mean, you know, I'm moving along, but
yep.
I think you can still make an argument that Objective-C had something going for it.
I still think it does. Here's why I'm not as grumpy, at least today, as you are, because I see increasingly Swift making these accommodations that allow for the Objective-C way of doing things.
Mm-hmm.
And some of my code, you know, if it looks a little ugly to me in the context of Swift, because it's doing things like, you know, dynamic type examinations of these objects, you know, for each item in this array, if it is a web blog post, then do this. That's the kind of stuff that I feel like is sort of in defiance of Swift, but hey, the fact that I can still do it is a sign that, I mean, I know there's some things we can't do in Swift that we can do in Objective-C, and I'm not sure how I'm going to get around some of those. But I kind of have a little bit of faith because they've given in on those fronts. You know, remember when Swift first came out, it was not at all clear that they would give in on any of those fronts.
Right.
And we were like on this show, we were like, well, how the heck, if you can't perform selector, you know, and then lo and behold, now you can perform selector.
And there's certainly something about having a project like yours that is so heavily Objective-C. It's like, there's this clash, right? Like two completely different ways about thinking about how to write code.
Yep.
A lot of this stuff kind of comes down to like, do you crash now or crash later kind of problems to me. And Objective-C is like crash later or never. And Swift is all about, no, I'm telling you right now, things are not going to work. And it's just a philosophical difference. And so when you have a project that is equal parts both or even more Objective-C, it's kind of a strange thing to like wrap your head around, like which philosophy wins. Like, what do you, I mean, if Marzet is 95% Objective-C and then you try to think like a Swift programmer,
yeah,
it's kind of strange.
Yeah. Well, so I won't go on too long about this, but I want to give you one example where I had a breakthrough where I think Swift really helped me make better code.
Okay.
And it was, I have to admit, I'm a novice at this kind of programming because I've been using Objective-C for years, and it doesn't exactly lend itself to it. I will say, actually, blocks in Objective-C opened the door to this kind of programming, but I never really got into using blocks this way, because I think in part because the notation was so clunky, and then weird stuff like having to mark variables as underscore block. It always felt a little dirty to me.
Swift is definitely progress in terms of blocks.
Yeah.
I don't love all of it, but the parts that I do love are much more elegant.
So I have like this, again, like going back to this kind of like state machine. Well, so just to set the context a little bit, this class I'm writing in Swift is trying to kind of encapsulate the whole process of a blog syncing with like a local blog on your Mars Edit syncing with the one on the server. So that has like lots of different phases and steps. You have to like different API calls, and depending on the type of blog, you have to do different things. And, you know, so you end up having a bunch of like, do this API call, and then when that returns, do this, and then maybe do this call several times. And so I had this one method I wrote where I was like, I had this breakthrough where I was like, oh, in Objective-C, I would have a bunch of instance variables that I tracked, like all the open requests and all this and that. And I realized in Swift, because of the closure approach, I can just like declare those, that state on the stack, you know, like as like local variables in the method, and they're right there. And then I could do this in Objective-C with blocks, but I did it with Swift. And it was one of these instances where I was like, oh, this is really lightweight. I can add this here. And it doesn't feel the same as adding an instance variable to a class. Like whenever I add an instance variable to a class, I'm like, should I really be doing this? And then for some, whatever reason, it just felt like more lightweight, and I felt like it was okay. I felt like it was all encapsulated in this one method. And I did like two levels deep of closures in this one method. And I was like at once feeling like that was a little dirty, but then also feeling like, wow, I just did like, I summarized it on Twitter by saying it's like with these closures, you can kind of turn a method into a short-lived object. Like it's the method creates all of its own instance variables, does its thing, and then deallocs itself effectively by getting to the end of its code path. And I don't know, I just kind of find that's eye-opening to me. And it might be that it'll eye-open me into writing a bunch of terrible code. I don't know. But I don't know. It was interesting. My eyes are open. I'm ready to take in the future of programming for the Mac if somebody smart comes along and gives us frameworks that are like suited to that kind of programming.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad it's working for you and you're so optimistic. I think my one parting advice maybe would be don't be too clever. Like this has served me really well over the years. And I think sometimes you have to be a little too clever and push the boundaries and to know where the line is. But I have seen some Swift code that is not going to be maintainable in 5 years when the developer comes back to it. So sometimes you can get caught up. I'm not saying you're caught up. I haven't seen what you're doing. But sometimes you can get caught up in the language and the novelty of how you write the code, not thinking about just how practical that code is actually going to be going forward.
Right. And in my defense in this case, I think this is in fact an example where quite the opposite is true, where it's more maintainable, more Good. Manageable, because it gets away from that whole problem. I mean, I think the whole beauty of closures is it gets you away from that idea of state existing kind of like in a separate space from where the code is.
Wow, you have drank the Kool-Aid.
Well, it's, you know, you're like, well, I don't know, how many open like requests are there? Well, it's right there in that local variable you just assigned. Yeah. You know?
That's good.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not like expert enough in it to say if it's good or bad, like in the big scheme of things, but I think that there are good things about it. And this code that I just wrote, it wouldn't be as good even with the blocks in Objective-C.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's cool. Well, like anything, you know, you can shoot yourself in the foot with any kind of code.
Yeah.
And I'm sure your code is great. I think you're a better developer than I am in terms of thinking through how to design the app. So that's cool. I'm glad you're excited. Yeah, I think you just caught me on a Swift ranty kind of day.
We should just call our podcast Code Therapy.
Right.
Usually one or both of us is like, ugh.
So I want to just wrap up this kind of segment. I want to point to a blog post that a listener sent in that they had written. This was Rob Farney had a post, and we'll link to it in the show notes. But I'll just quote the beginning of it, and listeners can check it out. He says, this is the beginning of the radical departure from Cocoa that he was hoping for. He's talking about a new version of Foundation written in Swift. He says, a day when all framework code for building Mac and iOS applications is void of Objective-C, or mostly void of it. Not that Objective-C and Cocoa are bad. They're not. It's just time to move on. And then he goes through some, you know, Cocoa Carbon kind of history. And so just, I don't know, something to think about. I don't think you've read this yet, so we don't need to, to kind of dissect it exactly, but...
Well, I haven't read it, but now I know why you're depressed, because this is this is the version of Rene Ritchie's article on iMore about like give up, you can't succeed on the App Store.
Oh, right.
This is the version of that for Objective-C fans. I mean, well, you know, not it's not a clear parallel, but he's not making any bones about the fact that he thinks Objective-C is on the way out, and the fact is, there are still many of us who are Objective-C fans. And so if you're still like we've been saying, you're still a little bit more skeptical about Swift. And I have to assume that that skepticism leaves you in a place where you kind of want to stick with Objective-C. And
yeah, it's, well, let me just correct you. I actually don't want to stick with Objective-C. Like I've moved on from that already, you know, like my new project is 100% Swift. And if I didn't want to do it 100% of Swift, I would have said, no, let's write this in Objective-C.
Right.
So it's like, I love a lot of things about Objective-C, and I love a few things about Swift too. But the thing that I hate more than any language quirks or beautiful ideas or any pros and cons is I hate programming in more than one language. And I already do server stuff, which isn't Objective-C or Swift. And the cost to me of switching languages all the time is way worse than any little nitpick that I would have over language. So I'm all in on Swift, but, and eventually I'd love to be Swift and Swift on the server too. And I mean, that would be great.
Yeah.
I would be very happy. And I think very productive when we get there, and hopefully we'll get there, but I still have things I like to complain about.
Of course.
Okay, this week we're happy to have Twitter and their Fabric suite of tools for developers sponsoring the podcast. We've talked a lot about how great Fabric is over the years and how I use it. Every time before we talk about the sponsorship, I kind of pull up their blog and pull up the Fabric dashboard to see what's new. And like right now I'm looking at their new mission control dashboard where you can see all your apps. I've got so many apps. I've got like a dozen or more apps in here. You know, a few of them are my own, some client apps. And it's just so easy to go through, filter them, kind of drill down into one and see, you know, how the crashes are going, if there's anything new, how many active users you have, different analytics about usage for your app. They just do a great job and they keep getting better. And they also do beta testing. There's a bunch of stuff it does. Beta distribution is really seamless and it works across platforms. So if you need something that works on Android and iPhone, they have that there for you.
Yeah, Manson, you know, I'm always trying to keep up also with what Fabric does for you, because it's ever expanding and I'm frankly have a hard time keeping my head around it. Fortunately, they do a good job of describing a lot of the stuff they do, if not all. If you go to git.fabric.io/kits, like app kit, you know, but kits, and they adopt that nomenclature for their URL anyway, and boy, they have like a bunch of stuff. They have all the stuff that's built in, the Crashlytics, the answers, the digits. And then, as we mentioned before, they just keep adding third-party stuff. You got Stripe for payments. You got Optimizely, Mapbox for, you know, if you want to have maps that are not the Apple MapKit stuff. Mapbox is really widely regarded as a great, great mapping service. And it's not so much that you can't use these services with, you know, without Fabric, but the fact that they make it so easy to just drop them in, using the system you're already hopefully using to drop Crashlytics in, maybe some of their other frameworks in. And, you know, something that comes to mind too is there's so many frameworks out there. Not only does Fabric make it easy to drop some of these in, but you know these frameworks wouldn't be there if the Fabric team hadn't sort of vetted them and said, yeah, this is a pretty good framework, right? So if you kind of like look down this list, you see a bunch of stuff. You can drop in a, I don't even know what they have from Nuance here, natural speech stuff. You look at this stuff and you say, hey, is there something here I could use for my app? Well, if Fabric is putting it on this page, it's not only going to be easy for you to add to your app, but chances are it's going to be a great framework. So you can kind of take this also as a kind of guide to great frameworks to see what they can add to your app. So thanks so much, Fabric, for supporting the show. And I think it's a perfect fit because we have so many iOS developers who can benefit from all the great services that Fabric offers. And once again, you can learn more at fabric.io.
Okay, Daniel, well, there's some news today as a recording that I think it really fits into what you and I like to think and talk about it because you have a blogging app, you have multiple blogs, I have a blog, I have
a blogging app
software that I might ship one day. And that's from WordPress today. The .blog top-level domain is coming. And I think this is really neat. It's basically for if you know listeners haven't been paying attention in a while, there's a whole bunch of new top-level domains. And you know, obviously, for the most part, over the last 20 years or whatever, we've had .com, .net, .org, a few other ones. And then these new top-level domains, at first, a lot of people's impression was like, well, who needs .coffee? That's silly.
Yeah.
But I think these are actually kind of catching on, and I like them, and I'm using them in my new product that one day I will release. And they're kind of fun, and I don't know, you don't take yourself too seriously when you use these, but I think they're becoming more and more common. And it's safe to use these. Like if you're worried that like you need a .com for something, I think don't worry about it. So anyway, .blog, what do you think? You going to switch to a red sweater .blog or?
I am just old enough to think that there's only three legitimate URLs in the world, .com, .org, and .net. Geographical domains. My first computer that was on the net was toast.santa-cruz.ca.us.
Right.
So I'm a little curmudgeonly. I'm a little bit like, who wants a .coffee domain? But I'll get used to it. I'm already warmed up to things like .fm. That just goes. It doesn't even bother me in the slightest when I see stuff like that.
.fm is funny because it's obviously taken off for podcasting.
Yeah.
We don't use it. I mean, I think that's fine. No. If you start with .org. I do use it on my timetable podcast, timetable.fm. The problem with .fm is they are ready to rip you off. I mean, that thing is $100 a year or something like that. Oh, man,
really? Jeez.
And it's kind of, compared to the normal, $10 that people are used to, it's kind of, it's a little frustrating that the pricing is so out of sync. Anyway.
My reaction. So I haven't read this post, but I'm sort of skimming it now as we talk. My first reaction was, "Oh man, that's kind of shady that like one company can take over a whole domain." And you know what? Now it's just going to be WordPress blogs that are .blog, and everybody else is going to be like, "I wish I could be a .blog." But of course, I should have had a little more faith in the sort of culture of WordPress, which I really respect, and I think it comes from many people, but Matt Mullenweg. Chief among them, of course, he has a good attitude about a lot of this stuff. And of course, as I skim down, I realize they're not quote unquote, they do own it. They secured the rights to basically administer it. So they sort of own it in that sense. I think they get to choose what they charge for the domains, stuff like that. But, my first thought was like, you're going to have to be a WordPress.com customer to use this. And they say straight up, again, the .blog domain will be available to everyone, regardless of what kind of site you have or who hosts it.
Yeah, that's great.
That's a total... I mean, that might even be required, for all I know, of the ICANN, of, registrar
status. I wouldn't be surprised. But I'm not sure, though, because doesn't Google own... It's like .goog or something silly.
Oh, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
And they do not let anyone have that, right? They use it internally only.
That sounds right.
Yeah.
So... this gets back a little bit to, we haven't hid the fact that we basically feel like WordPress is a good company. And this is interesting to me because, and when I say that, I mean like there's a little bit of implicit faith that they're going to do the right thing. And so if .blog has to be owned by a blogging company, I guess I sort of trust WordPress to sort of put values ahead of profit.
Right.
And so it's interesting. I scroll down also to the pricing section. It says domain registration prices are still being finalized, but it says they will be in the standard range for new top-level domains. And I don't know if that means, oh, it says with some premium pricing for higher value names. I guess that means like if you want tumblr.blog, exactly. You're going to have to talk to them.
And that's pretty standard, I think, with, I've seen some of those kind of, the new top level domains, I've seen some of that kind of stuff. And they also talk a little bit about how it's going to be rolled out, which is also consistent with some of the other top level domains where there's like an initial period where people that have trademarks or they if you wanted marsedit.blog or something, like, mm-hmm. you know, you have like an early period where you can maybe get that before someone else and maybe you have to pay extra. I don't know, but that is fairly common. But my reading of this kind of standard pricing thing is definitely going to be in the $10 to $20, not the $75 to $100. That's how I read this.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that's just sort of their attitude. It's funny that we ascribe that quality to them because they make a ton of money off of their WordPress VIP mm-hmm. hosting. I have to assume they make a ton of money because it's like $500 a month or something.
Yeah. It's good business probably.
Per site. But at the other end of the spectrum, It's sort of like the Apple Watch. You got the Edition up top, and then you got the Sport Watch. And I mean, they seem very concerned about the average person having access to things. So it wouldn't be in WordPress's DNA, I don't think, to make .blog domains inaccessible to the masses. And so that is an aspect of this that I think is reassuring. It's like, you know, assuming .blog becomes a valuable thing to have, mm-hmm. well, WordPress is going to make it so you can get, you know, core intuition .blog would not be a premium price.
No. You know? And most blogs are just going to be called something random, like they always are. They're not going to be like a, you know, Toys R Us.blog or, you know, some brand name, Target.blog or something. They're going to be some silly name that someone came up. The thing that I love about this, well, two things. First of all, I agree with everything you said about WordPress as a company and their culture and their kind of priorities. And I said on a blog post a while back that there's only really two companies that do hosting that I trust to be around for the next 100 years. And that's GitHub and WordPress. Those are the only two companies that do hosting that I would trust that they're not going to just go under in the next 5 or 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I'm counting like everything, Twitter, like everything in that medium. I like that about them, but there's also this advantage in terms of owning your own content. And how do you own your own content? How do you really have control over things? Well, you have to have your own domain name. It can't be manton.wordpress.com. It needs to be manton.blog.
Right.
And that small change is huge. That it doesn't seem like much, but it's really big because it means you can move your content.
Yep.
It means you have control over things. It means people can't take your site down. You have control. This .blog is just a DNS thing. There's no proprietary fancy thing that's going to go away. It's just how DNS works and hasn't really changed in the last, you know, 20 plus 30 years. And it means you can move your site. It means that there's a longevity there that would not be there if you just had something.tumblr.com or something.wordpress.com.
Yeah. I'll say one more thing about this, which is from a selfish, business-minded, red sweater, Mars Edit developer point of view, I think this is great news for me.
Yeah.
Because it's an example of WordPress doing marketing for the concept of blogs.
Yep.
And, you know, the fact is WordPress is a CMS. And so you get a bunch of stuff out there that's not blogs. And you can use Mars Edit to edit it, but it's not exactly the target market. You know, you go to like Ford or something and they got like their whole catalog of cars that are managed with WordPress. You go to a restaurant and the menu is all WordPress. I don't exactly see that as my customer base. Although maybe I should. But, you know, when you got a .blog domain, if they get people starting talking like, oh, you got a new domain, .blog, that's cool. And, you know, there's still a lot of people out there who don't really get what a blog is. Mm-hmm. And
I think this is a super great point. And think about, I mentioned Medium in passing. You got a Medium. How many times do you think they say blog when you sign up or they're marketing?
Right.
Never. So, I mean, think about that. I mean, Medium is just a place to host a blog and you know, that it's bug software, right? But yeah. They don't talk about it that way, right? Because they're interested in their own brand and then and trapping eyeballs in there. And so I agree. WordPress is doing exactly the right thing to have something that's bigger than just WordPress, something that helps the actual internet and the web.
And it meshes with your ambitions, too, to keep promoting various kinds of blogging.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it is a sort of like, hey, let's make sure that we all agree that there's still something called blogging. And it's not exactly Twitter, and it's not exactly Medium, and it's not exactly a Ford catalog of cars, and it's not exactly a restaurant menu. And it's not exactly NBC's like news page or the New York Times, right? Yeah. It's like something else, and it has a name, and it should continue to have a name.
Yeah. It kind of blogging implies a kind of, it has a kind of connotation to it that you think about a personal site. You think about, you know, actual individual writing and publishing to the internet, which is a special thing that should be preserved. That is, like you said, it's different than the Ford corporate blog. That is a blog, but like when you think of blog and you think of dot blog, you think about a person.
Yeah, it's like straight from the source. It's
exactly.
It's the concept of like straight from the source, maybe edited, but if it's edited, it's edited by friends or peers, and it's not edited from like a top down hierarchical point of view. And I think that's what's really fun about blogging is you can still have a very high quality, very refined content, and you could still have it be a blog, or you can have it be, you know, I think Tumblr exemplified this when they came out with like their Tumblogs or whatever. Mm-hmm. And Tumblr, it's like Tumblr blogs.
There you go.
Yeah. And, you know, the idea that it could be like kind of just like your personal fire hose. Right. And I love that. It is a very personal thing. And, so yeah, in summary, I think I'm fine with .blog domains. I think you may have said this first. If there's any big corporate presence in the world that should be in charge of administering it, I think it probably should be WordPress. I can't think of a specific example of a company that is simultaneously as invested in blogging and has demonstrated such a sort of philosophical slant towards empowering people.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. This is kind of neat. And I'm going to look at ways I can maybe use this somehow. I'm not sure how yet. I'm not going to register a bunch of domains because I have plenty. But I like this. And they're also going to allow, like, you won't have to just register a domain through WordPress. Like, they're going to allow, it's very common to be able to register domains in, from lots of different places, right? And they're going to allow that as well.
Right. They just have to sign up with whatever, Namecheap or Hover or whatever, and say, yeah, you can sell our domains.
Exactly, right. And I think that's cool. I mean, who knows? Maybe I'll sell people .blog domains. You never know.
Okay, folks, we're happy to have back sponsoring the show our friends at Linode. And Linode is, of course, a VPS, virtual hosting company. If you need a Linux box to host a website, a private Git repository, or maybe to serve as a backend for your latest iOS app, consider Linode Cloud Hosting. They've been doing infrastructure as a service since 2003. They give their customers free upgrades, and they have 8 global data centers equipped with industry-leading data center-grade SSDs. Now, this isn't your normal like shared hosting thing from years past. This is, in my opinion, kind of the best way to do hosting these days. You get full root access to your own virtual machine, so you get full control of everything, including containers, everything about your machine. Maybe I shouldn't say everything, but you know, it feels like you have a full machine to deal with. They give you clear, precise hourly billing, and you can set a monthly pricing cap so things don't get out of control. They have add-ons for load balancing, system metrics, and backups, and of course, they have full year-round, 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week customer support. So if you ever run into a problem, you'll be well covered there. They have a great promo for listeners of our show. You can use the coupon code CoreIntuition20, and that will get you $20 off, which is essentially, if you start at their lowest tier, That's 2 free months. So give it a try. You can go to linode.com/coreint and learn more about it and start your, you know, I don't want to call it a trial, but if you use that credit, it practically is one. Give it a try at linode.com/coreint.
Yeah, one of the great things about Linode is that although they kind of charge and think about monthly pricing, you could spin up a virtual server for a day and then turn it off and you're only charged for that day. So it's really flexible. I like it because it's simple. It's like they give you the basics to run your own server and then a few key things that you need. For example, if you need load balancers, if you have multiple web servers like I do on Linode, you can have that. If you need some stats package so you can see how your disks are performing and CPU usage and things like that, you can have that. Another thing I don't think I mentioned on the show is backups. They have a backups feature that you can add. So if you don't want to deal with some kind of automated, I don't know, archiving files and sending them up, you know, to S3 or some other backup server or something, you can just enable with one click backups on Linode, and they have a few. They'll rotate your backups automatically, so they'll keep track like the backup today and then one from, you know, 2 days to a week ago, and then a backup they'll save from a couple weeks ago. So they'll kind of rotate them out just in case disaster strikes and you delete your database and you need to go back a day, or just in case you forgot about something and you need to go back, you know, a whole week or so. They'll kind of manage that automatically for you. If you need that kind of stuff, it's there. And of course, you can just start with simple servers, spin it up and customize it however you want. So thanks to Linode for sponsoring the show. You can learn more at linode.com/coreint.
All right, Manson. Well, I'm not really close to shipping any new updates at the moment, but the good news is if and when I ever ship an update again, apparently it will be approved by Apple within 1 to 2 days.
Nice. I saw this. If this isn't a fluke, this is a huge improvement. App Store review times on iOS and the Mac, apparently,
yeah,
are down to just a day or two, which is fantastic. It's, you know, we like to complain about the App Store, and review times is one of the things. Because if you want to turn around a bug fix update, or you just have some features that you want to actually ship to customers, waiting the week that it usually takes and has taken for years is just painful. So I love this.
Now, I wonder if it had started out, if the App Store had started out with 1 to 2 day review times, if we would have ever celebrated it.
I probably would have still complained, because 1 to 2 days is still really, really long compared to to 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Which is what it takes when you distribute your own software. But yeah, the just the difference between 7 days and 1 day is huge. So Phil Schiller, he's getting to work.
Hey, maybe. You know, this is a great example of just like quietly doing things that are better. And, you know, it's not like they sent out an announcement that was like, look at us, 1 to 2 days.
Right.
This is only through observation, through like the review times. I forget the URL, but we'll put it in the links. It's
I think appreviewtimes.com, maybe.
Appreviewtimes.com. Hey, that's what it is. Yeah, and it's from Shiny Development, same folks who put out the Mac, the iOS Dev Weekly. So great. They're doing a lot of great service for the iOS and Mac community. But yeah, you look on this site right now, appreviewtimes.com. Boy, it's just like a ski slope. It's like, it looks like a Alto's Adventure going down the iOS App Store and Mac App Store trend. And the 14-day trend starts on iOS at 3 days and is now down to just under 2 days. And on the Mac, it started at under two for a 30-day trend and is now down to one and a quarter day.
This is great. Like you said, it's not like a revolutionary change or whatever. I mean, there's big changes that we would like in the App Store, but there's so much that Apple could do just with a lot of small improvements like this, where it's like things are just better. They're not radically different, but they're just better. And I'm certainly happy about this. I'm working on an update to an app, and I just the knowledge that when I send it off to Apple, I'm not going to be waiting an eternity is nice. And of course, there's still edge cases that might take longer, and there's still the possibility of getting rejected and everything that goes along with that. But it's progress.
I feel also like I haven't been rejected as often, and that might be because I'm not submitting bugs. I mean, because there's been some legitimate times when I was rejected for good reason, but I feel like it's been a long time since I had like a bashing my head on the table, like what the hell is wrong with Apple rejection. Yeah. And maybe it's just because I'm not submitting updates enough, but,
well, you've been doing a lot of like minor improvement releases versus a major.
Yeah. But I sweat every time because in particular, don't tell Apple, Mars Edit, it's still not sandboxed.
Right. That's true. Yeah. You never know when they'll be like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah.
What's happening here?
I've noticed a trend with Apple, and I don't want to raise any awareness, I guess, at Apple about this, but you know, don't change anything, Apple, just to prove me wrong. But I've noticed a trend, which is that sometimes like they make like a big policy change, and then after a little while they get tired of paying attention to it.
Hmm.
And like, I don't know if you remember, like years ago they said like you can't have, they said you couldn't like squat application titles in the App Store. And there was this was like 5 years ago now, and they were like, you got to get these things shipped,
yeah,
or else, you know? And I don't remember. I think one of my apps, I just like submitted an app and then never, and got it approved and never released it. And now it's just been squatting there for 5 years.
So I think that is that's the loophole though, right? If you submit an app with a name, it's only if you have an app created and never submit it that they can.
Yeah.
They can pull it out. But as long as you've submitted it, it's like it's in their system and it's too much trouble for them to like untangle it. I've had that happen too.
I just sort of wonder if like, you know, you go enough years, like which they made this policy decision about sandboxed apps, right? Where they said from now on, all apps in the Mac App Store have to be sandboxed. And then they said, yeah, we understand we started this store a year ago and said, any app can be part of the App Store. So we're in a little bit of a predicament. So, okay, you can keep your apps in the App Store, but you can only do quote unquote bug fix updates. And then years go by. And I remember like Panic got like one release held up because they were like, that's an awful lot of bug fixes. And they're like, well, excuse me. You know?
Sorry but, for being responsive to my users.
Right, and so like it's kind of like over the years I've been like, is this a bug fix or is this a feature? Sometimes it's a little hard to tell, especially when you're trying to keep pace with, you know, changing world. And, you know, and there was always also this explicit exception for keeping up with OS features. So if you added a new feature that was like take advantage of full screen mode on Mac OS, then that was okay. But I kind of wonder now, like over the years, there are going to be fewer and fewer people working in App Review and working at Apple who even understand, who even remember what like the pre-sandboxing days were. Like it's been 5 years now or something.
Wow.
And
so what do you think that means though? So you're saying there's a bunch of new people that don't even, but is that good? Is that bad? Like, because I mean, we still have people, developers pulling out of the store, and you mentioned Panic, and that's a famous example with Coda. Like they don't have their new version in the App Store, and a lot of it is about sandboxing.
I don't want to jinx it, but I have the feeling that the longer time goes on, like if I don't know, I'm planning to sandbox Mars Edit, but I have a feeling that if I for some reason didn't, 20 years from now, if I was still lucky enough to be selling on the App Store, whoever was working in review would have no idea what that meant. And it would be like, this is just another app that's being submitted. And I don't know how they're handling it. I don't know how they're managing it now, whatever like grandfather status allows. Because I think if you try to upload something to the App Store that is not sandboxed from scratch, it probably triggers something, right? Probably says like, sorry, you're out of here.
Which is, but that'll be a problem if you ever release something that you want to charge for. Because it has to be a brand new app.
And that's essentially when I probably will change to sandboxing. But I have another app, for example, FastScripts, which is not likely to ever meet the requirements of sandboxing. And I don't know if I'll ever release another major update to that either. So we'll see. But so then maybe that's a better example. 20 years from now.
Yeah.
I think 20 years from now, if FastScripts is still in the App Store, maybe I could release a major update to it. Not sandbox it, and nobody would know. Nobody would even remember what it means. So it just kind of makes me wonder, like, 20 years from now, I think that's probably true.
You're forgetting that 20 years from now, we'll all be running iOS. Fast scripts won't run.
I know. So I just use the 20 years as an extreme example because I want to then kind of compare with that. Well, it's not 20 years now, but 5 years is an awful long time, especially I find the whole app review career very hard to put my head around. Like, I don't know too many people. I've never met too many people who work in app review. I don't know how much of a lifetime career it is. My guess would be it's not a lifetime career. My guess would be there's some kind of like turnover in that realm.
I think that's true. It's got to be true.
So a lot of people working today on app review on the Mac are probably there was this period of time like when Panic got dinged where everyone was like, okay, remember folks, remember what they said at the team meeting, we're going to go out and we're going to be on the lookout for scandalous non-sandboxed apps. And whatever team meeting they have when they're like, okay, this is what we're looking out for, this is the priority this week, I don't think they're talking about sandboxing anymore.
Interesting. Well, I like your optimism, but you can't count on that. You can't build a business around that.
No, you can't. But you can't, but it makes me curious now. Like, I almost think like maybe I should try to make a major update to Fast Scripts and submit it and see what happens.
It would be an interesting experiment. It'd be a great way for you to procrastinate shipping new version of Mars out.
That's right. Well, it's a good thing nobody, absolutely nobody from AppReview listens to the show, and nobody who knows anybody who works in App Review would tell them about this line of thinking I'm sharing. But I don't know. I think that there's something to that where Apple kind of gets uptight about something for a while, and it's just it becomes like not their biggest concern after a little while. You know?
Well, yeah. There's certainly when a new feature comes out, we see this on iOS.
Yeah.
Pretty often. With iOS 8 and 9, we saw this, where there's a whole bunch of rejections, and everyone's freaking out and saying this is ridiculous. It's not great the way it plays out, but often you have some time, and then these apps start being approved, and it's no big deal. But there's that initial, like you said, like Apple is just hyper-focused on like, oh, you're trying to do something new.
Yeah.
Can't allow it. I'm thinking of things like extensions. There's a lot of weird rejections around extensions that were very frustrating for developers. And some of that is still in place, but some of that is kind of not quite as big a deal anymore.
Yes, I don't know. I mean, it's, there is something, I think, to the idea that your reviewers have to have expertise in what they're reviewing for. So it's like, okay, you go to the airport and you've got like... I don't know, like from 1850, like a little vial of opium or something from 1850. So do they even know what to look for? Right. At some point, it's like if you got like outdated forbidden stuff, then you don't get, I don't know. I'm being naive here, I'm sure. But there's something to that. I think there's something to, if you weather the storm long enough, then you just get, I don't know what, and I don't know if there is actually like a, I don't know how they administer that. I don't know how, like when I upload a new version of Fast Scripts, how it doesn't have to have sandboxing.
I mean, it might, for all we know, it's automated and they look at like the version number or something like, oh, this is newish looking. And like it flags that it's not sandboxed or something. I mean, I don't know. Like we just don't know how this. I assume some developers have gone through this and they have a better idea and they've been on the phone with App Review and they've kind of figured this out. I'm sure Panic has a real detailed understanding of this. And I'm kind of defer to them too and others that have been through this and have left the App Store. Unlike me, who I just kind of threw a fit and left the App Store with the blog post without talking to Apple. I think some of these developers actually tried to make it work and it just didn't.
So I should try to change Fast Scripts into a full-fledged FTP app that lets you mount your own mountable FTP volumes and then see if I get through.
Or you could do this. Forget about Fast Scripts because that'd be fun, but like do your new version of Mars Edit. Try to submit it. I can't remember if your new version is sandboxed or not, but like try to submit it not sandboxed and see what happens. Of course, this is, I mean, you probably shouldn't do this because it would totally disrupt your release routine and everything. But that's the real test. Like, can you release an actual new version? Yeah.
I could make a fake new app that's not sandboxed and update and upload it and just see what happens.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll call it Sandbox.
Well, don't tell them. Yeah. I mean, maybe I'll try this at some point. I'm going to actually release a new version of my Mac video app Clipstart, and I'm just going to release it directly, but I don't know. Yeah. I still have this like, you know, placeholder in the Mac App Store that is, you know, removed from sale or whatever. Maybe I'll just try submitting and see what happens, because it's never going to be sandboxed.
Yeah, it's something I try to remember. There's no penalty for submitting, at least not that I know of. Maybe if you do submit a ton, they put you on a blacklist or something. But like, I try to remind myself, it's okay. It's maybe like not in the spirit of the Apple's guidelines, but you can sort of submit as a test. And
I did that in my latest unreleased product. I submitted what I called 1.0, even though I knew I was going to do more, just to see how things were going to go. And also because I had the idea that I might use it as like a widespread beta, since you need to sign up for an account really to use the app anyway. And it was rejected, and I went through all this in-app purchase kind of rejection thing. But then it was approved, and I have not released it yet.
Mm-hmm.
And that was months ago, right? But I did go through that process just to kind of see how it would go and to have it. Once an app is approved and there, it like takes some stress off, you know, mm-hmm. and then you can kind of get back to work. And I don't feel bad about that because, again, as it wasn't my idea for Apple to approve apps. Like, it was their idea.
Right.
So like, they have to deal with the workload of doing it. Like, it's not my idea. I would much rather apps be able to be installed by end users, you know, with some different, you know, different options like we're used to on the Mac and even on Android in some cases. So is their idea to invent the App Store? So like, they need to deal with that. And I don't feel guilty about submitting. I don't submit that many versions.
No.
So just a handful every year.
Well, anyway, and on the point about using submissions as a test, it's now faster than ever to find the results of those tests.
Yeah, that's good. Anyway, yeah, getting back to the positive, you know, aspect of this, anything like this is good. And I, you know, we're leading up to WWDC in only a month. We're going to be heading out there to San Francisco, and any goodwill that Apple wants to kind of roll out to developers, I'm all for it.
Absolutely. And I'm in a pretty good mood. I feel like I'm sure I'll have some more Apple down points in my career. You can't be in the Apple ecosystem for 20 plus years and not have some down points, but feels like to me, I mean, I know like Wall Street has a little bit of a down attitude about Apple right now, but I think Apple's attitude is improving right now. It feels to me like they are in a making amends kind of phase. And maybe that is being too optimistic, but like, you know, like you said, these little things that happen, you know, just like silently reducing the time that review takes, they could pick like probably 50 things and do like one little thing per week. I mean, I know that would take work and it's probably not likely, but boy, it would add up, you know. It would just be like, oh, finally you can, you know, this little search bug on the App Store doesn't behave this way anymore. Or, you know, there's just a ton of little things they can change. And I think it feels to me like maybe they are kind of doing that. I don't know. We'll see how WWDC comes along and how what they have to offer us. And hopefully some big things, but hopefully also some more of these little things that just sort of make livability on the App Store more realistic.
Definitely. And looking forward to WWDC. I think in the next week or two, maybe next week, we'll start talking a little more about the conference in terms of predictions and like what we're hoping for. But for this week, we're going to wrap it up. Thanks, everyone, for listening to the show. Thanks to our sponsors. Don't forget the jobs board, jobs.corrent.org. We just had a new job go up there today. So if you're looking for an iOS job or you're looking to hire best iOS and Mac developers, you know, there's a lot of people that read the blog, follow the tweets on Twitter, see the Facebook posts. If you want to get your job in front of some great developers, check out jobs.corrent.org.
Yep, great stuff. Thanks for listening, everybody. And of course, you can get in touch with us on the Slack channel, chat.corrent.org. And Manton, I'll talk to you next week.
All right, bye.